This is Writer's Voice, where the conversation goes deeper. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
And she was in a rage. She felt violated as a writer. She felt that she was going against all her creative instincts. She was very sick. And she went back to Concord and sat down at the stinky little desk that her father had built for her, just in a fury. And in about 6 weeks, she wrote, you know, one of the best-selling books of all time.
That's our first guest today, Susan Cheever, talking about Louisa May Alcott. She's the author of American Bloomsbury. And later in the show, we'll hear from Kitty Flory about Sister Bernadette's Barking Dog, the quirky history and lost art of diagramming sentences. But first, American Bloomsbury. Back in the mid-1800s, one of the most extraordinary genius clusters the world has ever known arose in Concord, Massachusetts. It caused an American renaissance in literature and thought that in many ways, my guest Susan Cheever says, was a precursor of the counterculture of the 1960s. Her book about it is American Bloomsbury, Louisa May Alcott, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Henry David Thoreau. Cheever is the author of several other books, including My Name is Bill, a biography of Bill Wilson, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a memoir of her father, the writer John Cheever, entitled Home Before Dark. Well, Susan Cheever, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be here.
Now, your book, American Bloomsbury, for those of our listeners who may not know the reference, tell us why you called it that.
Well, I called it American Bloomsbury because it's about a genius cluster. It's not about Bloomsbury, which was a genius cluster of writers and artists in Britain at the beginning of the 20th century. I used Bloomsbury as code for the genius cluster of writers who gathered in Concord, Massachusetts in the 1840s and 50s. This was a group of astonishing people in a very small place, all of whom knew each other, all of whom were in and out of each other's lives. And in the case of the Concord group, this was the group of men and women who basically wrote American literature and, you know, lay down the ideas that we live by now, feminism, closeness to nature, you know, a humanistic God. I mean, all these ideas came from this group of people, and I had always been interested in them, and F.O. Matheson, who was a very distinguished American studies scholar, had once said that all of American literature was written between 1850 and 1855, and I looked at that and studied it, and I came to see that almost all of American literature was not only written in those 5 years, but a great deal of it was written in three houses at a crossroads in Concord, Massachusetts, three houses in which you had, either as residents or visitors, Hawthorne, Emerson, Thoreau, Louisa May Alcott, Margaret Fuller, Horace Mann, Herman Melville. I was just blown away by that. It just seemed amazing to me. And I started with Louisa May Alcott because somebody, Random House, had asked me to write an introduction to a new edition. And I reread Little Women, and I was just stunned by it. It's not at all a book for young girls. I mean, it is also a book for young girls, but it's an extremely accomplished and wonderful novel. And it's really the novel that created the archetypal American woman who we see everywhere now. And it's also the novel that elevated domestic details to fictional importance. In other words, before then, nobody wrote about cooking or sewing or the things that women do in their private lives. Anyway, I was just amazed by Little Women. And so I started reading biographies of Louisa May Alcott and found that Laurie, who's the boy next door in Little Women, was based on Henry David Thoreau, and that Thoreau lived across the street from the Alcotts in the Emerson house, but that Louisa not only had a crush on Thoreau, she also had a crush on Emerson.
I'd like to ask you, why do geniuses seem to be grouped together in specific times and locations, and do you have any theories about that, well, first of all, in general, and then second of all, what was it about this time and place that brought them all together?
You know, it's a fascinating question, what makes a genius cluster? And there's been a lot of research on genius clusters in general. Some people think that genius attracts genius. Some people think that genius attracts competition, so that if there are a few geniuses, young men who want to be geniuses go there to see, to measure themselves against the existing geniuses. But I also think, and I think this is what happened in this particular case in Concord, Massachusetts, that a genius cluster can be started by one extremely charismatic individual with some money, and that was Ralph Waldo Emerson. Without Emerson, this Concord, Massachusetts never would have happened. Without Emerson, we would not have American literature as we know it today. There's no question about that. Emerson took some money that he had, that he actually got from suing his first wife's family for her fortune, went to Concord, bought a big house, married a woman who was extremely efficient and compliant and artistic, and set about creating a literary community. He invited Thoreau, who already was in Concord, to come and live at the Emerson house. He helped Thoreau get through Harvard. He invited Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was secretly engaged but couldn't figure out how to set up household, to come and set up household in Concord with his new wife. He invited the Alcotts, Bronson Alcott, to come by telling Bronson that he would pay his rent and that in Concord, Bronson would find an audience. Bronson had had a very hard time in Boston. He assembled this community, and he continued to assemble a community in Concord almost throughout his life. But clearly his biggest accomplishments were the Hawthornes, the Alcotts, Thoreau, Margaret Fuller. So I think in this case, the genius cluster was created by this central charismatic figure.
So put us back in that time and in that place. I've passed by this area many times when I've gone to Boston on Route 2.
Right
through Concord, and I also took some European friends of mine who are great admirers of Thoreau to Walden Pond. But tell us what it was like back then.
Well, I had the very amusing experience. You know, I had been reading about Concord and immersing myself in the work of these people, and I was on my way to New Hampshire with a car full of children and dogs, and I decided to stop in Concord, and I somehow expected that I would drive down Route 2 into 1850. And, of course, I drove down Route 2 into a huge traffic jam, and it was about 110 degrees, and everything was shut, and whatever it was the kids wanted, they couldn't get. And it was just a disaster. But I kept going back, and I think that the old Concord is still there. You just have to look a little bit to find it.
And there's a picture of you right in front of the Orchard House, which was Hawthorne's.
No, that was Louisa May Alcott's house.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's right.
The wayside next door was Hawthorne's house. But I just kept going back, and I found, I stayed there for a week one February at the Colonial Inn, and that really helped, because in February, especially early in the morning or at twilight, it is very much like 1855. I mean, there are more trees, you know, the wildlife is a little different, the North Bridge has been rebuilt, but you can imagine very clearly, partly because the Emerson House and Orchard House and the Hawthorne House are as they were. You can imagine what it was like quite easily. And even one evening in the summer, you know, I walked down from the Old Manse to the river with my kids. And, you know, it's the old Concord is there if you take the trouble to look for it. If you can rent a canoe at the old South Bridge. And the river is very protected and very much like as it was when Thoreau took his boat down it. So it's there. You just have to give it a chance.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Susan Cheever about her book, American Bloomsbury, Louisa May Alcott, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Henry David Thoreau, Their Lives, Their Loves, Their Work. Now, you say that these folks were the first professional authors. What do you mean by that?
Well, they were the first group of American writers. I mean, there were professional authors in England, but they were the first professional authors in the United States. I mean, there were not, before them, there were not people who made a living writing books. It was it was sort of a new idea, and it was part of this whole explosion of creativity and joy, really, which happened in New England in the 1840s and 50s, which was quite extraordinary, and very much like what happened in this country in the 1960s. There was this kind of outpouring of freedom, and, you know, Emerson's essay, Self-Reliance, was really part of this emphasis on the individual, which was brand new. And I think that until then, in other words, the revolution was in 1776, and so it took about 50 years for it to sink in that we could enjoy European things without being afraid of being dominated by Europe, and that we could have a love affair with nature instead of thinking of nature as a terrible enemy that we needed to beat down in order to survive. And we could imagine a God who existed in other people or in nature instead of a punishing Puritan God. So all these things kind of came together at once. You know, you even had Nathaniel Hawthorne saying, I want my own thing. He didn't say I want to do my own thing, but he practically did.
And of course, Thoreau said, turn on, tune in, and drop out, although maybe he didn't say turn on. Now, you know, you mentioned the 60s, and I've thought often that it was a kind of a resurgence of American Romanticism that was like German Romanticism or even the Rousseauian French Romanticism. And when I read your book, it occurred to me that this was an earlier connection there. Can you say that this was like an American Romantic movement allied
exactly.
to those?
Exactly. That's what it is. It's the first American Romantic movement. And it was quite electrifying. I mean, and for the first time, intellectuals went back and forth from England, and Margaret Fuller brought German literature to Concord. So all these, it was extremely exciting. And I think that people felt, or certainly writers felt, and intellectuals felt, and poets felt that, you know, for the first time they were able to plumb the landscape of the human heart. Because before that, it had really been about surviving and surviving as the United States.
And they were called the Transcendentalists. What were they transcending, and why were they transcending it?
You know, there's a huge amount of discussion about what Transcendentalism means, and no real conclusion. But clearly, what they transcended were the old Puritan ways. All the rules and regulations about society, certainly all the rules and regulations about what you can and can't believe when it comes to God. Emerson gave a very famous speech at the Harvard Divinity School, which got him kicked out of Harvard for 30 years, saying that essentially God is everywhere. So transcending those old strictures about, you know, what God was and what God wasn't, and also to some extent, you know, they transcended these rules about marriage and these rules about what women did and what women didn't do. You know, it was about transcending the old ways, the old rules and regulations, and coming to a new understanding of what it meant to be human in this beautiful place. And certainly Margaret Fuller, for instance, transcended very much the idea of what it had meant to be a woman. Of course, everybody believed in those days that women were inferior in every way. And, you know, Margaret Fuller was the editor of the Herald Tribune. She was a foreign correspondent. She didn't get married, you know. And
she had a child out of wedlock.
She had a child out of wedlock. She, you know, fell in love with who she pleased. She did what she pleased. She was educated as if she was a man, which is to say she was educated at all. But, you know, at the same time, they thought it was a big deal to let her use the Harvard Library. So, you know, the idea of a woman even going to Harvard was just not dreamt of in their philosophy. They transcended, really, the old ways, and they called it the newness or the awakening, and I think it felt that way. I think it was a very exciting time to be alive.
You're listening to Writer's Voice on Valley Free Radio. Visit our website at www.writersvoice.net. You can find links to our podcast there, which is also podcasting on Valley Free Radio, as well as other links and information about the show and the show's guests. Now, Susan Cheever, you paint a picture of a new sensual and even sexual freedom. certainly there's a whole kind of undercurrent of eroticism that you talk about in the book, and a lot of multiple and even intersecting love triangles. But you also call them high-minded prudes, where, you know, this was a time when even table legs were hidden. You know, in other words, there are a lot of contradictions here. Give us some examples first of who was in love with whom, and then talk about how they worked with these kind of contradictory elements.
Well, I think the high-minded prudes were not... I think these people were not, in general, high-minded prudes. In other words, I think the prudishness was really what they were trying to put behind them. You know, the people who felt that you couldn't hang clothes on the line without putting a pillowcase over the clothes, lest men see ladies under things. I think that, you know, the transcendentalists, if we're going to call them that, were very much trying to get away from that. But the love triangles are sort of interesting. Because it was such a close-knit and intimate community, there was a great deal, and I'm using the word love and the word love affair not literally, but there was a great deal of intimate connection. Both of the Thoreau brothers fell in love with the same woman, and first John Thoreau proposed to her and she turned him down, and then Henry David Thoreau proposed to her and she turned him down. And then both Nathaniel Hawthorne and Ralph Waldo Emerson were very involved with Margaret Fuller, to the extent where Emerson got so jealous that he, you know, had the Hawthornes kicked out of Concord, essentially. And then Thoreau lived at the Emerson's house, and he and Mrs. Emerson became very close friends, especially when Emerson would be gone for a year. In fact, that's how Thoreau ended up going to Walden. He had been living at the Emersons for a year while Emerson was abroad, and the Emerson children adored Thoreau. All children adored Thoreau, and Emerson's wife, Lydian, loved Thoreau, and he loved her, and Emerson came home, and of course the house was way too small for the Emerson/Thoreau family and the Emerson-Emerson family, so Emerson said to Thoreau, you know, you can't stay here. And Thoreau said, well, I don't really have anywhere to go. And Emerson said, well, you know, I have a woodlot I just bought out on Walden Pond for $89. Why don't you go out there and build a cabin and live out there for a while? And that's why Thoreau went out there. He wasn't intending to be a hermit. He just didn't have anywhere else to live.
You just said you don't say love affair literally. So there is a way in which I think there these heated passions, you even suggest that they may have been as heated as they were because you don't think that they were consummated.
I don't think that they were, but I'm not sure. And I think all scholars and unscholars of these people very much wish that there was more documentation on this. But I certainly couldn't find it. I mean, I looked, you know, I imagined finding a letter from Emerson to Margaret Fuller, but I didn't find it. It's, at the moment, not there, although letters are turning up all the time. Actually, in the last 6 months,
really?
Interesting things have turned up. Yes, Thoreau, as you know, at one point built a fire in an old stump to roast some fish and set fire to Concord, to 300 acres of it. And some of the people whose land was burned, letters have just surfaced of theirs. So, you know, things are still coming to light in people's attics, the famous New England attic. And then I just learned, you know, the famous story of how Louisa came to write Little Women.
Yes, tell our listeners that. That was quite a surprise.
Yes, well, that was one of the first things I came on back when I was starting with this, but she had written a novel called Moods, which she thought was a wonderful novel and her breakthrough novel, and it was about a woman very much like her who was in love with a man very much like Emerson and another man very much like Thoreau and the agony of her choice. And she thought it was going to be the novel that put her on the map as a serious literary person, and it didn't. And it also got a very bad review from Henry James, who said... the lack of the ignorance of this writer about human nature is equaled only by the confidence of this writer in what she knows about human nature. I mean, a really mean review. Anyway, she then went down to Washington to work in a hospital during the Civil War, which was a really life-changing experience for her. And, of course, she also got very sick down there and was given medication that made her even sicker. And she came home, and then she wrote a little book called Hospital Sketches about her time in Washington, in which I think she really found her mature style. And then she wanted to write another significant novel. So she went to her editor, Thomas Niles of Tickner and Fields, and she said to him, okay, I want to write a really significant novel. And he said, well, I can't sell a book like that that you would write. And she said, well, what could you sell? And he said, well, the only thing I could possibly sell that you could write would be a book for young girls. And she said, absolutely not. She said, after everything I've been through, I am not going to go back and write children's literature. So he said, well, too bad. That's the only thing I'll publish. And she, you know, in a complete sort of fit, and she had been very discouraged before, so she was used to having people tell her that she couldn't do what she needed to do as an artist. But anyway, she went to Boston. She turned him down and went to Boston. And what Thomas Niles did was he wrote to Louisa's father, Bronson Alcott. And this is the letter I just saw for the first time about a month ago. He wrote Bronson a letter saying, you know, I really wish that Louisa would write this book for young women, and I think I would be able to, you know, pay her enough to make a difference to your family. And of course, Bronson, if she was to write this book for young women, I'm sure I could see my way to publishing a book of yours.
Wow.
So it was a double bribe. Mm-hmm. And Bronson wrote to Louisa and sort of summoned her home, and she was in a rage. She felt violated as a writer. She felt that she was going against all her creative instincts. She was very sick. She was a spinster. She had given up everything for this hungry family of origin that she came from. And she went back to Concord in a rage and sat down at the stinky little desk that her father had built for her, just in a fury and, as I say, very sick. So sick that she couldn't write with her right hand. She had to learn to write with her left hand. And in about 6 weeks, you know, one of the best-selling books of all time.
And we're talking with Susan Cheever about her book, American Bloomsbury. You know, there's a wonderful passage in your book. Do you have your book with you there?
Yes, I do.
Because you describe what it was like for her to write this book.
Sure.
I wonder if you could read those paragraphs, starting when she looked up during the day, and if you could read it down to her teacher and friend Thoreau.
Okay, yeah, this is chapter 47, so...
Or maybe actually down to across the hall, the three paragraphs.
Okay, great. When she looked up during the day, past the rustic board fence her father had built at the edge of the property, she saw people in carriages passing on the Lexington Road, and beyond the road, pastures sparkling with wildflowers. When she rode at night by candlelight, she communed with a family of barred owls that lived in the broad branches of the huge elm tree outside her windows. As she wrote during the day, she could sometimes look down from the window and see her father, not working in the gardens behind the house, but sitting on the bench with a pile of his finest red pippin, apples, waiting for the occasional traveler who might be ready for a dose of his own brand of high philosophical discourse. Sometimes Emerson dropped by. Sometimes Alcott would entertain a special visitor from Boston, like Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, or Franklin Sanborn would wander up the Lexington Road to talk pedagogy, or one of the Hawthorne children would come over from next door. Beyond the meadows lay the shimmering water of Walden Pond and the fields and marshes where Louisa had taken so many passionate walks so long ago with her teacher and friend Thoreau. The little half-moon-shaped desk her father had built for her sat at the foot of Louisa's bed, surrounded by her books in a crowded cabinet bookcase, her sewing basket, family portraits, flower paintings by her older sister Anna, and a bust of the poet Schiller on the mantel. Although Orchard House was unheated except by fireplaces, and the Alcotts in later years often closed it up for the winter and moved to Boston, Louisa's room had a fireplace and windows facing south and west toward Concord. her parents slept in the bedroom across the hall.
Could you say, how did you get this level of detail? I mean, some of the things, you know, about Bronson Alcott, I'm sure that it was pretty well known with him and his apples, but how did you get these details?
The details about Louise's bedroom, I was just thinking as I read them, it's a photograph.
It's in the book, too, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Essentially, I'm describing a photograph of her bedroom, including the bust of Schiller. And so in this case, a lot of the details come from photographs. A lot of the detail in my book came from letters and journals. And God bless these people, because they all wrote extensive letters and journals, just so extensive, so detailed about the furniture and what they ate and what they wore and what they did and the weather. And so it's possible to recreate a lot of scenes with pretty good detail.
And as you point out also, of course, so much of what Thoreau put into Walden came from his journals. You quote a wonderful sentence, "I went into the woods to live deliberately so that I might, from the essential facts of things, and might not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived." You credit him with simultaneously inventing the memoir and the nature book.
Well, I think he did. I mean, Walden is sort of the first American memoir, and it took him 9 years to get Walden published, which is one reason why it's so good. He rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it. But it's definitely written from memory. And he also wrote the nature book. I mean, that's what Walden is as well. But to go back to it being a memoir, Walden is very full of Thoreau's personality, and he was a very crotchety type. He hated rich people. He felt that it was never okay to drink alcohol. He was a strict vegetarian. He had some very crotchety ideas. He did not like taking charity. He had taken enough charity for a lifetime. And those ideas, you know, he used Walden to kind of express his own personality through recalled anecdotes and images, which is, I think, a definition of memoir.
Right. And I was also surprised that, I mean, he's such a great figure now, but he never achieved any kind of success or recognition, really, other than from the people who knew him when he was alive. And you mentioned Walden. It was an absolute bust.
It was, yes. It was.
Why?
I mean, well, it just, they didn't get it, you know? I mean, it wasn't, I mean, you know, The Scarlet Letter was a huge bestseller, and Little Women was a huge bestseller, and Walden was a very strange book. I mean, everybody thought that Thoreau was going to be the sad acolyte of James Russell Lowell when history was written. But
and
of
who,
course,
who was that?
Exactly. That's not how it turned out. But Walden is such an extraordinary book, and I do think it is so extraordinary because it was rewritten so often.
And it, you know, he really was, is the word avatar? I mean, he was really ahead of his time.
He really was. He really was.
And it, ahead of his time by about 100 years.
Yes. Although he wasn't so much ahead of his time as ahead of our intelligence.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, the things he wrote about were true then, you know, that you can find more solace in nature than you can in many things, that leading a simple life is a good thing to do for many, many reasons, that closeness to nature and the rhythms of nature are healing, that charity is awful, that it doesn't work and it only feels good to the giver and not to the receiver. You know, many of the things he wrote about were true then and are true now. We just didn't see it. I mean, it was just the reading public that failed to understand what a brilliant book it is.
You also say that both with Walden and with Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, that the impetus to write these masterpieces came with despair.
Well, and that's true of Little Women, too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the reasons I wrote the book, of course, was to find out for myself what was behind this genius cluster of writers so that I could do what they did and write a masterpiece myself, I mean, of course. And what I found horrified me. What I found was that, it, certainly in those three cases, that the greatest work comes from really having nothing left to lose. And I hope that's not true. But if you look at Walden and The Scarlet Letter and Little Women, it's very interesting that these people were really, I mean, Hawthorne had given up writing, you know. They really were in a very dark place when these extraordinary works were written by them. I thought it was very interesting. And what's even more interesting is that I don't think Louisa May Alcott ever wrote a book, again, that was as good as Little Women.
Or before.
Nor did Hawthorne write a book, again, as good as The Scarlet Letter. Nor did Thoreau write another book. So it does suggest to me that although there perhaps isn't this big link that everybody thinks there is between writing and drinking and womanizing and carrying on, that there does seem to be a link between kind of intense creativity and really having nothing left to lose, really being at a point in your life where you just are ready to risk everything on, you know, a roll of the pen.
So you're kind of saying is this tortured genius theory is true?
Well, no, they weren't tortured. They were just, they were done.
Uh-huh. It's the giving up.
It's the giving up, I think, that sometimes creates the astonishing thing. But another thing to be said about both Hawthorne and Louisa is that because they had given up, and because they had both been through quite difficult passages in their life, I mean, Hawthorne lost his mother and got fired from his job, which he had only taken because he had given up writing, and then lost Margaret Fuller, who certainly was alive in his imagination, and Louisa had really lost everything. And in both those books, there's such a sublime quality of yearning for something that's been lost, yearning for something that didn't happen. I mean, Little Women, it just, to me, you can almost smell it coming off the page. I mean, that is the family that Louisa May Alcott so desperately, desperately wanted to have.
The one that was like her family, but the version she wished it had been.
Exactly. Because it wasn't really like her family that much at all.
Right.
You know, I mean, Louisa was the rebel, but she was not loved for being a rebel. She was disliked for being a rebel.
And her family was grindingly poor rather than genteelly poor.
Exactly. And she made up a servant, for instance, Hannah. It's complete fictitious. You know, and her sister's death was not a calm letting go, but rather a desperate, horrible. So I think it was close enough to what had happened so that she was just desperately yearning for it to be as it was. And I think Hawthorne also was very affected by Margaret Fuller, by her having an illegitimate child, by her death, and it just is yearning for her. And I think that sometimes intense yearning can be a tremendous goad to creativity, and that's a little more bearable information than having to think that you have to let go of absolutely everything, although that's probably true too.
And so have you been able to use that in your writing? Or do you anticipate using it?
Well, I have such a yearning for Concord. It's interesting. There's something about Concord, Massachusetts, and I'd like to write about Concord again. I feel a sort of yearning for Concord. You know, that lazy river, the willows brushing the water, all those things.
Well, Susan Cheever, it's a wonderful, fascinating story that you tell in American Bloomsbury, and I want to thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
The book is American Bloomsbury, Louisa May Alcott, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Henry David Thoreau, Their Lives, Their Loves, Their Work. Next up, after the break, Kitty Flory tells us about the lost art of diagramming sentences. Stay with us. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Well, listeners, I don't know about you, but when I was in grade school, one of the few fun things I can remember about the experience was diagramming sentences. Instituted as a way to teach children grammar, diagramming was in vogue from the early years of the 20th century until the 1970s. Many decry the poor grammatical skills of today's college students, who were born after diagramming sentences went out of vogue. Is there a connection? I don't know, but my next guest, Kitty Burns-Flory, knows all about diagramming sentences. She was a copy editor for many years, and she wrote an essay for Harper's Magazine several years ago that she's expanded into a charming and instructive book, Sister Bernadette's Barking Dog. Well, since your book, Sister Bernadette's Barking Dog, is such a marvelously written book, I wonder if we could start out this interview, actually, by having you read something from the very first page.
I would love to.
Okay.
All right. Diagramming sentences is one of those lost skills, like darning socks or playing the sack butt, that no one seems to miss. When it was introduced in an 1877 text called Higher Lessons in English by Alonzo Reed and Brainerd Kellogg, it swept through American public schools like the measles, embraced by teachers as the way to reform students who were engaged in, to take Henry Higgins slightly out of context, the cold-blooded murder of the English tongue. By promoting the beautifully logical rules of syntax, diagramming would root out evils like him and me went and I ain't got none, until everybody wrote like Ralph Waldo Emerson, or at least James Fenimore Cooper. Even in my own youth, many years after 1877, diagramming was serious business. I learned it in the sixth grade from Sister Bernadette.
So tell us, who was Sister Bernadette?
Sister Bernadette was a very tiny, very brisk, very smart little nun who took no nonsense but was quite nice. She wasn't one of the mean ones. and she taught us how to diagram. And I have never forgotten what she taught me, so she must have been pretty good.
So tell us, what is diagramming sentences?
Diagramming sentences is a system of lines and angles. It looks like a road map, and the words are strung out on those lines, as I said in the book, like clothes on the wash, so you can see them. You can see exactly where they go. You can see what modifies what, and it's a diagram showing what language looks like. It's pretty extraordinary.
A diagram that shows what language looks like, how does it do that? This is one of the few times that I feel that radio is at a disadvantage, because your book is filled with the most incredibly complex drawings, constructions. I wonder if you could just auditorily orient us to this visual medium.
I can start with the sentence Sister Bernadette started with, which in my recollection is the dog barked. And you draw a straight line, and you write dog on the left side of the line. You write barked on the right side of the line. And you bisect the line with a little short line between those two words. And the word the goes under the word dog at an angle going off to the right, so that you can see that the modifies dog. And if it was the brown dog, brown would go on another little line next to the to show that you're talking about a brown dog. And so dog is the subject of the sentence. It goes on the left. Walked is the predicate or the verb. It goes on the right. And there you have it. It's pretty simple, at least when you're doing the dog barked. And then when you've got the dog doing a lot of other complicated things, of course, it gets a little crazier looking. But that's the basic, those are the basic elements of sentence diagramming.
Now, you said subject and predicate or verb. Tell us, what are some of the important grammatical concepts that are involved with diagramming?
I think that one of the important things is to show exactly what modifies what, so that when you have a sentence like, and I'm trying to think of an example, if you have a sentence like, trotting down the road in a red collar, I spotted the dog, there's something very, very wrong with that sentence, and it's what is known as a misplaced modifier or a dangling modifier. What is meant by the sentence is, I spotted the dog as I was walking down the road, and he was trotting down the road in a red collar. It's a mistake that a lot of people make. But when you diagram that sentence, trotting down the road in a red collar, I spotted the dog, you realize that it's I who is trotting down the road in a red collar, according to the way the sentence is arranged. And you can immediately see, at least Sister Bernadette hoped that we could immediately see, that that was wrong, and that we would have to rephrase the sentence somehow so that it would be the dog who would be trotting.
Yeah, as you said that, trotting down the road in a red collar, I was trying to wrap my mind around that idea that you were trotting down the road in a red collar. And there was a little disconnect there.
Right. If we had a diagram here, you would have caught on right away.
That's great. Well, you know, it's funny. I asked my 86-year-old mom about if she had studied diagramming sentences, and I assumed that she would say yes, but she didn't, and she grew up in New York City. I was very surprised, because growing up in northern New Jersey, as I did when I was a kid, we diagrammed sentences. So talk a little bit about the history of diagramming sentences, and also how common was it?
It was very, very common, and I was surprised too, because just recently I spoke to someone who grew up in New York City who didn't diagram, and I think New York City was a pocket of resistance to the Brainerd-Kellogg methods. Maybe the teachers had too much else to do to teach kids how to diagram. Maybe they just never got around to it, couldn't afford the whole concept. You know, teachers had to be trained. They had to buy all these books. But from all over the rest of the country, every single person I've talked to since this book came out last October and before when I was researching it, everyone over a certain age had diagrammed sentences. And I don't remember now what the statistics are, but I think something like 90% of American schools were using this method in the early 20th century. And it certainly hadn't died out by the time I was in school or you were in school. And in fact, my daughter had a little bit of it. She's in her 30s, and she had some. And there are places that teach it today.
Talk a little bit about the history of it, and about the early history of it. First, there was a man who didn't do it quite the same way as the Brainerd-Kellogg method. His name was S.W. Clark, and he actually went to Amherst College, which is...
Yes.
Right in this town.
Yes, right. He invented a system of diagramming that was actually a system of balloons that were hooked together. And they, as soon as I saw them, they reminded me of those balloon animals that they make at state fairs and at kids' parties. They look like little dachshunds and, you know, dinosaurs and stuff. And they're really crazy looking. But they do sort of show how the words relate to each other in a sentence.
What did this come out of, actually? Because it seems that there was something really about that time, and tell us the time that this was. It's something about that time that gave rise to a desire to bring grammar to the masses.
I think that was true. The book was published in 1877, so they were working on it at the Brooklyn Polytechnic where they taught.
This was Alonzo Reed
and Brainerd Kellogg, yes, mm-hmm. Two very earnest professors at the Institute. And they polled their colleagues and talked to a lot of people and tried things out on students, and they came up with this method. And they refined it and perfected it and published their book called Higher Lessons in English. At the time, well, of course, teachers have always thought that their kids needed, you know, some really rigorous drilling to get the language drilled into them properly. So, of course, they wanted to improve their students' writing and their use of it. But at the same time, it was a time when, in the Victorian era, in America, there was a great desire for self-improvement of all kinds. And that's when penmanship was in its heyday, and etiquette, and table manners. You know, all kinds of rules were laid down, and posture, and people had calling cards, and engraved stationery, and everything was very formal and nice, if you could afford it. And I think people who were upwardly mobile in those days could seize on these trappings of gentility and become ladies and gentlemen automatically if they improved their speech and stood up straight and learned how to behave the way, you know, the upper classes behaved. So the country was ripe for this method, because it promised to teach kids to speak proper English.
It reminds me, we had a guest on here late last year who wrote a book called Service and Style, which was about the department store, the American department store. And what you're talking, which also its heyday was in that time,
yes,
in the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also a way to kind of bring the style of the upper class to the middle classes.
That's true. And strangely, the department stores began to die out just around the time diagramming did. You know, we don't really have very many of those old department stores that I certainly remember when I was a kid.
No, that's right.
And now we have, what do we have? We have Target and, you know, Kmart. And what are they? They're sort of department stores, but nobody would ever call them that. And they're certainly, the atmosphere is certainly not the same.
Right, although they're trying to gentrify a little bit.
Yes, but they're never, you know, there were Oriental rugs on the floor and beautiful old cash registers, and, you know, the salespeople were dressed up and they were behind glass counters.
That's right. Why do we need diagramming?
I think that diagramming can't hurt, but I don't necessarily think it's the only way to teach people how to write and speak good English by any means. And diagramming itself has problems. You have to learn how to diagram, for one thing. You have to learn this very, very involved system. And also, as I also point out in the book, and I think it's really funny, you can diagram a very bad sentence. It doesn't have to be a good sentence. You can put it on those little lines, and nothing is telling you that it's bad unless you already know it's bad.
Could you give us an example of that?
Well, I have examples in the book, which I can...
Actually, one of them is, me and him went out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's no reason you can't put me and him on lines just as you could put he and I. And to a lot of people, me and him went out sounds like a perfectly good sentence. So telling them to sit down and diagram that sentence and see what's wrong with it. You can't see what's wrong with it. But if you've had a Sister Bernadette who has already instructed you in proper grammar, and then you sit down with the diagram and try to make it fit, then you will realize that it's, you know, you have to know it before you can diagram it. I see diagramming as a reinforcement of things that students have already learned, not as a way to teach it.
Now, we interviewed linguist Jeff Pullum, and he's the co-author of a book called Far From the Matting Gerund. And he took a distinctly live-and-let-live approach to grammar. He basically says that grammar usage is always changing, and it's perfectly legitimate. And you yourself say in your book that, quote, to try to hold back language change is like trying, as Monty Python would have it, to cut down the largest tree in the forest with a herring.
Exactly.
But you also are a veteran copy editor.
That's right.
Your job has been to correct poor grammar. What's the balance that we want to strive for here between live and let live and grammar and correct grammar?
Well, as a copy editor, I sit on a very uncomfortable fence. I am a stickler in written English and things that are going to be published. Certainly in my own books, I try very hard to make everything absolutely correct. And I think that formal written English is the last bastion of correctness, and that there's absolutely no harm for it to be there. It needs to be there. It shows us what the language should be. And it's quite different from the language that people speak or write in emails or write in personal letters, if anybody writes personal letters. The language is, of course, always changing. It has to change. It's a living thing. It has changed drastically from the Middle Ages or from the Renaissance or even from 100 years ago. But I think what bothers people is when it changes too fast. And everybody always thinks that the language is changing too fast. We can certainly accept the fact that we don't speak the way we did 100 years ago. We don't talk the way Washington and Lincoln talked 200 years ago. But when we speak quite differently from the way we did, say, 20 years ago or 10 years ago, when people can remember, and of course we all idealize our childhoods, but people remember their childhood as being a time when people did speak better English. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But it's true that there's always been a sort of tension between the idea that the language has to change, should change, and becomes more interesting as it changes and with new words and new constructions, and the idea that we're losing something really important.
You say at some point in the book, as a matter of fact, it's where you actually quote or you refer to Stephen Clark, who was the first guy. The Balloon Man, where he compared grammar to geometry and architecture. I wonder if you could say what he means, and then I'll follow it up with it.
Clark does compare it to geometry and to architecture, and I think that students who are mathematically inclined and visually inclined are the ones, besides the students who are just fascinated with language, I think that those are the students who find it fascinating and who have always found it easy and have always welcomed it as a way of another way of looking at language, to think of it as something like a mathematical equation or like a picture, the way architecture is a picture. Grammar is like architecture. It's like an edifice in which there are all these rooms, and you know, if you look at it that way, and there's a picture in the book of one of those birdhouses that has all the parts shooting off of it for, you know, I think it's purple martins who like that kind of birdhouse. It's a structure on which you can put the language.
Say more about the birdhouses. Describe that for our listeners.
Well, in a section where I was showing how extremely complicated diagrams can become, I was at the same time looking through a book of birdhouses because I was in the market for a birdhouse for my yard. And we came across this purple martin birdhouse that all of a sudden I thought, that looks like one of these diagrams, and we have to put it in the book because, you know, you can imagine the birds going in and out of different places the way the nouns and verbs and adjectives and adverbs go in and out of all the little rooms or the little streets.
That's wonderful. Now, here's a good example, I think. And it's one of my favorite sentences in the book, although there are many wonderful, wonderful sentences in this book of all different kinds. But this is from Groucho Marx. And I think it shows us what diagramming really can do. And it says, time flies like an arrow, but fruit flies like a banana. Or, actually, time flies like an arrow, but fruit flies like a banana.
It's all in the emphasis, yes. And it's all in the diagram. That's one sentence that becomes so clear when you diagram it that it was actually a joy to diagram it and see it on paper like that. And the diagramming guru who helped me with the diagrams and, in fact, did the really tough ones, a man named Jean Mutu from Kentucky, who has written a great book about diagramming sentences. This one I could diagram on my own. It was one of the ones that's actually fairly easy to diagram. When I sent it to him just to make sure that it was right, at first, when I had just written the sentence, he didn't really understand it. And then he saw it diagrammed, and he just cracked up. He thought that this was so funny.
And you did choose a lot of very wonderful sentences. I'd like to ask you about Gertrude Stein in particular, because, you know, her kind of writing, probably a lot of people would say, is not grammatical because she dispensed with so much punctuation.
Right.
Talk about who she was and talk about her love affair with grammar and some of her sentences.
Gertrude Stein was an American writer who spent most of her life in Paris. She went to Paris when she was young, and she hung out with Picasso and Hemingway and that crowd in the 20s. Gertrude Stein was a modernist, and her use of the language was very much in that tradition of trying to get rid of all the old structures and rules that had held her back. And her own writing was extremely distinctive. However, one of the things that I discovered as I was researching this book was that Gertrude Stein absolutely adored diagramming sentences. She learned to diagram in California when she was a girl. And she came to the United States from Paris in 1935. She was nearly 60 at the time. She was very famous by then. And she gave a lecture tour here. And one of her lectures was called Poetry and Grammar. And in that lecture, she said this amazing sentence. I couldn't believe it when I came across it. But she said, "I really do not know that anything has ever been more exciting than diagramming sentences. I like the feeling, the everlasting feeling of sentences as they diagram themselves," whatever that means. But the funny thing is that many of her sentences are not diagrammable at all. You cannot diagram them. They would stump Sister Bernadette. They would stump my friend Jean Mutu in Kentucky.
Why is that?
Would stump me. Well, I can give you an example of an undiagrammable sentence by Gertrude Stein from her novel called Lucy Church Amiably. "He made many, many tickle them as well as withstand." Now, that's a kind of a typical Gertrude Stein sentence. The grass is a tall, sudden calendar with oats with means, only with cages, only with colors and mounds and little blooms and countless happy eggs to stay away and eat. Eat that." Maybe you could diagram it. I don't really see the point.
Right. And you have some very long sentences there. What is your favorite, most complicated sentence in the book?
My favorite one is the Proust one, because it's the longest and most complicated. And, of course, it's a little silly because Proust wrote in French, and the French didn't diagram. Nobody diagrammed but Americans. It was only an American phenomenon.
Not English, either?
None of the other English-speaking countries have diagrammed. They did a thing called parsing, where they just identified all the parts of speech in a sentence, but they didn't put them on lines. So our Proust example was there just to be funny because it's just such an extremely long sentence.
And it takes up, we have to say, two entire pages.
But on the other hand, so does our sentence from Jack Kerouac, which is also a beautiful, wonderful, perfectly diagrammable sentence.
Maybe read both of them just so we have a...
Okay, look. I will start with Kerouac because he's right here in front of me. And this is a lovely sentence. It's the last lines of his famous book, On the Road. The evening star must be drooping and shedding her sparkler dims on the prairie, which is just before the coming of complete night that blesses the earth, darkens all rivers, cups the peaks, and folds the final shore in. And nobody, nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody besides the forlorn rags of growing old. Mm-hmm. So that's a lovely sentence. And then we have Proust somewhere here. It's a little unfair to Proust, to diagram Proust, because he would have, you know, run screaming in horror at the very concept of diagramming sentences.
Why?
I think that Proust just wasn't oriented that way. He was much more interested in the what the sentence would say rather than in how some teacher would put it on the blackboard with lines. The Proust sentence, which takes up two pages and is almost impossible to figure out from the diagram, which I think is actually another drawback of diagrams. You can put the sentence on a diagram, but you can't necessarily read it back because you don't really know where you're going. However, here's Proust. But at least if strength were granted me for long enough to accomplish my work, I should not fail, even if the results were to make them resemble monsters, to describe men first and foremost as occupying a place, a very considerable place, compared with the restricted one which is allotted to them in space, a place on the contrary prolonged past measure, for simultaneously, like giants plunged into the years, they touch epochs that are immensely far apart, separated by the slow accretion of many, many days in the dimension of time. That's a very complicated sentence.
Now, you mentioned before that it has largely fallen into disuse, but you did visit a classroom where diagramming is taught. Why don't you say a little bit about that?
I did. I visited a classroom in Greenwich Village. It was a bunch of seventh graders on Valentine's Day who were all dressed in some fairly alarming Valentine outfits, some of them. The idea was to wear red and for the girls to look as sexy as possible at age 12 or whatever they were, around 11 and 12. But aside from that, they diagrammed sentences in their English class that day, as they did every Tuesday, and they were absolutely loving it. They had such a good time. They made a lot of mistakes. The teacher was very patient with them, but you could tell that they were getting it.
Was this something you think they had been exposed to before? Was it just this
teacher?
No,
this particular teacher really believed in it. She had done it as a kid, and she had loved it, and she was determined that her students were going to do it and that they were going to like it, and they did. They were really excited.
Now, can it make you a better writer to know how to diagram sentences?
I do not believe that it makes you a better writer, and nor did this teacher who was teaching the students in this seventh grade class. I think the only thing that makes people a good writer, and it's very easy to become a good writer, you just read a lot.
Yes.
You know, it's the easy way. You don't have to study grammar. You don't have to diagram your brains out. You don't have to do anything. You just have to read books all your life, and you will be a much more competent writer. Not that we don't all make mistakes, even those of us who read a lot, but it's really an easy trick.
That's right, and it's really fun.
It's a lot more fun than diagramming sentences.
Although that's fun,
it
too.
It is fun.
Well, the book is Sister Bernadette's Barking Dog, The Quirky History and Lost Art of Diagramming Sentences. And Kitty Flory, thanks so much for coming on to Writer's Voice today.
Thank you. It was lots of fun.
Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice, airing on this station and podcasting on the web at writersvoice.net. Next week, we'll talk with Eric Kleinenberg, author of Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. To learn more about Writer's Voice, visit our website at writersvoice.net. Until next week, I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.